Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, July 10th, 2016, and this is show number 583. Well, we're on high baby alert around here now. Lindsay's baby is due on the 20th, but he's shaping up to be a big boy already, so the betting pool believes he will be early. Now, there's two reasons you need to know about our impending grandbaby. Number one, because if there's anything that might get in the way of the NoSillaCast coming out on time, this could be it. There's a much better than average chance that there won't be a live show next Sunday. If she has a baby early next week, we could be at MacStock, or if she doesn't have the baby, we might be at home. It's hard to say. The second reason you care that we're having a grandchild is that you should probably unfollow us on social media completely. Now, remember how insufferable we were when Tesla first arrived in our lives? And then it happened again with the kittens, Ada and Grace? Well, can you just imagine how annoying Steve and I will be when we have a grandchild? I'm telling you, take this as a warning. If you don't heed it, you only have yourself to blame. Well, I've mentioned that the SMR podcast is one of my favorite shows. The hosts, Chris Ashley, Rob Dunwood, and Rod Simmons are great guys, have an interesting take on tech, and also discuss social issues, TV shows, sports, and gaming. They can be all over the map, but they're always interesting and always entertaining. Well, this week, all of them were out of town, so they asked Terrence Gaines, also known as Brother Tech, and me to host the show for them. We had an absolute blast talking tech, doing it, and I hope you'll go subscribe to hear episode number 308, which Terrence named Ebony and Ivory, over at smrpodcast.com. When Chit Chat Across the Pond this week, Bart takes us through the last episode of Learning the Language of JavaScript in Programming by Stealth, episode 18. We learn a few new things, tie up some loose ends, and get ready to step outside of the playground. Go check it out. It's episode number 446 of Chit Chat Across the Pond over at podfeet.com. Or even better, subscribe to Chit Chat Across the Pond in your podcatcher of choice. As if all of this was not enough fun for one week, my full 50-minute video tutorial on Affinity Photo is now up on Screencast Online. I told you that I'd done one earlier, which was just the extensions, but this is the full application now. This was really challenging to make because I had to cram a super capable image editor into such a short amount of time. Luckily, Todd Oldhoff had just finished a four-part series on Photoshop for Screencast Online listeners and viewers, I should say, so I didn't need to explain how to use an image editor, but rather to explain the interface of Affinity Photo and highlight any unusual tools it has. The more I worked on this video tutorial, the more I learned about how incredibly capable Affinity Photo actually is. The folks that make Affinity Photo have over 40 short videos showing how to do specific things, but they didn't have a video explaining the interface yet. I've been watching their short tutorials, even their new beginner series, and I learned something new that an Affinity Photo can do every time. Just this morning, I saw one explaining how you can add new light sources to your photos. That looks like black magic to me. Can't wait to test that out. Anyway, Don has a free 14-day trial for Screencast Online, so you can go use that to see the video, or you can buy it a la carte on the Apple TV using the new Screencast Online Showcase app. You can, if you don't want to do it that way, you can also wait till the end of the month because my Affinity Photo video tutorial will be in the Screencast Online magazine for iPad as well. I'm rather proud of this video. Can you tell? I hope you go watch it. A couple of weeks ago, I told you about a sweet little text editor called Cot Editor that Trevor Drover found in response to Alistair's challenge on Google Plus. I loved it, but said in my review that the one thing I missed from using Atom was a way to see whether I had correctly closed all of my brackets and parentheses. It seemed to sometimes show the matching brackets, but I couldn't find the pattern to when it worked. I suggested in my review that since Trevor found Cot Editor, it was his job to find the pattern for me. Well, Trevor wrote back. He said, you threw down the challenge to me to find out why Cot Editor sometimes highlights brackets when navigating code. Well, my preliminary investigation found that the system is not very good, but reproducibly shows that if you place your cursor before the end bracket, then use the forward arrow key to pass over the bracket, it will briefly highlight the bracket at the start of that function. I'd like to see it work both ways. Well, I tested Trevor's method, and indeed, it does work. What he means by both ways is that Cot Editor only lets you move over the ending bracket to show you the starting one, but you can't arrow over the starting one to find the ending bracket. I definitely would like to see it work both ways and keep it highlighted, not just briefly. In any case, I think it's a minor problem, and I'm still loving Cut Editor from cuteditor.com. I'm really lucky to know Steve's dad, Ken. You may remember him from his video appearance entitled Octogenarian Talks 1Password. He's not super technical, but he is very motivated towards security. He works really hard to understand the risks of online computing and to do whatever he can to mitigate these risks. He's actually a great example to us all. A while ago, Ken wrote me a message telling me that his Airport Extreme had a blinking amber light on it instead of the normal solid green light. I looked at mine, and it was blinking amber as well. I unplugged it, waited 10 seconds, and plugged it back in, and the light turned green. I wondered what it was, but suggested my father-in-law do the same thing. He did it, and he got the green light as well. About a week later, Bart told us about an important firmware update to the Apple Airport line of routers. I told him about the amber blinking light we'd seen, and we concluded that the unplug, plug it back in trick had caused the firmware to be updated. I'm not sure about Bart, but I thought that was pretty slick. But then this week, Ken wrote again to say that he had the blinking amber light again, and sure enough, mine was blinking as well. Perhaps Apple had issued another update, but that seemed really soon for it to happen again. The first time this happened, I had opened up the airport utility to see if I could see an alert about the router, but I have such a weird setup with my routers now that I wasn't actually able to see the router with the airport utility, even when I switched my Mac from the Netgear I normally use to the airport that handles only the Internet of Things in my house. I could see a nice green dot next to the internet icon, but no physical airport showed up on the window. A note at the bottom said, "No configured airport base stations have been found." Well, this time that he wrote to me, I figured I'd better think a little harder on why the airport wasn't showing up. I hunted around through the menus, and I noticed a button entitled Other Wi-Fi Devices. I pushed that button, and it showed that I could select my Thunderbolt Ethernet connection or Wi-Fi, and it had defaulted to Ethernet. I toggled it to Wi-Fi, and suddenly my Airport Extreme was showing up in the airport utility. Now, this is when things got interesting. There was a nice big red 1 next to my router's name, and if I clicked on it, I was shown the usual information about the router, like my IP address, but also the firmware version. It said I had 7.7.3, and right next to it was a little button to update. Well, that would have been useful a few months ago if I'd actually gone in and figured this out. I went online to see what the latest firmware update was, and it turns out Apple issued 7.7.7 for the Airport Extreme back in May. So, yeah, you heard me say that all you have to do is unplug and plug it back in your airport to get that firmware update. Erase that from your brain right now, because that's not what you have to do. I opened my trusty Clarify before I ran the update. I took screenshots and annotated them as I ran through the quick steps. My father-in-law loves my tutorials. He prints them out and puts them in a notebook for safekeeping, so it's fun to make them for him. I figured this would help him. Maybe it would help others. So, of course, I posted the tutorial, How to Upgrade Apple's Airport Firmware, up on podfeed.com. For most No Silla Castaways, though, it's a pretty simple process. You kind of push the button that says update. But I figure you guys might want to point your friends and relatives at this so you don't have to walk them through it. This week's dumb question comes from Steve Laddams, and it's a fantastic question. He wrote, "Dear Allison, love the show. You bring technology to the masses. Well done." Why, thank you, Stephen. Anyway, he says, "I have a question about macOS security as my first Mac, an early 2009 24-inch iMac, and my son's Mac Mini from 2009, secondhand from eBay last year, will not be supported on macOS Sierra. Both machines work okay. The iMac is very quick given its age, so I have no wish to replace either of them, but I'm concerned that I will fall behind on security updates if I cannot get into 10.12. Can you let me and your other listeners know if my older Macs will become vulnerable from October, or if Apple still issues security updates for older OSs, and based on current updates available, how far back this might stretch? Thanks for your time. Yours sincerely, Steve Laddams." Well, I love this question because it shows that Steve has been carefully listening to Bart and me when we say that the number one thing you can do to keep yourself secure is to make sure your software and operating systems are patched. That's why Bart's tagline for Security Bits is "Stay patched and stay secure." The good news is that you don't necessarily have to be on the latest operating system in order to get security updates. Apple has been fantastic lately at supporting the latest OS on much, much older hardware, but as Steve says, many models that can run El Capitan will not be able to run macOS Sierra. We can't say for certain what Apple will do in the future, but traditionally, they have kept operating systems up to date two versions back. For example, the latest security update to OS X, or do I already call it macOS? Anyway, the latest security update they've done is 2016-001. And according to Apple Knowledge Base article HT201222, this security update was released for El Capitan, Yosemite, and Mavericks. If they keep up the pattern, that would mean that when macOS Sierra comes out, they would continue to patch not just El Capitan, but also Yosemite. Bottom line for Steve and everyone else is that you definitely do not have to replace your hardware yet. And if it's running well, just make sure you allow the operating system to continue to run the updates as they come in. There will come a time when your hardware can't be updated, but that time is definitely not now, Steve. You've probably got another few good years on those machines. And this is one of the things I think most people don't take into account when buying a computer, that while Macs cost a lot more on the front end, they're useful for far longer than a cheap PC and have higher resale value. However, if you've got hardware that technically can run a supported OS like El Capitan, but it's running super slow, you might be able to repurpose that hardware by making it into a Chromebook. I did that about a month ago with a 2008 MacBook, and it went from super slow to snappy with the Chrome OS. I have to admit that I haven't tried a nuke and pave on that little Mac, so that might have sped it up too. If you're interested, I put a link in the show notes to a blog post I did about doing this using Cloud Ready to build a Chrome OS installer for the Mac. You know, now that I think about it, I have now essentially done the nuke part of a nuke and pave by putting Chrome on it, and so I could go back and install El Capitan on it later to see if that sped it up. I got to tell you, it usually does. Shai is in the live chat room right now, and he said he just did it to his Mac, and he couldn't believe how much faster it was. Anyway, thanks, Steve, for an awesome dumb question that I bet will help a lot of other people understand what we mean by stay patched and stay secure.
Hi, this is Denise with a Castaway review of the Octobud SM01-X7 waterproof Bluetooth earbuds. They're available on Amazon for $49.95 U.S. The key feature is that they're waterproof and rated to IPX7, so I couldn't wait to try them for my evening swim. IPX7 is defined as protected against water immersion for 30 minutes at a depth of up to 1 meter. First, some backstory. I've been trying for years to come up with the best audio experience for swimming. I first had an iPod Shuffle in a bulky silicone case with wired waterproof earbuds. It sounded terrible. A few years later, I upgraded to a WaterFi Shuffle. This is a standard iPod Shuffle, but it's coded to be waterproof. It's great, but I still had to manage a headphone cord and had to remember to update my playlist. Sometimes a girl just wants a nice midnight swim to Dark Side of the Moon or to have a coaching app barking instructions in her ear. The Octobuds are Bluetooth 4.1, which means they use less energy and pair faster than devices on older Bluetooth specs. In that regard, they don't disappoint. They connected to my iPhone right away, and I'm getting 8 hours out of each charge. The range is 10 meters. The Bluetooth 5 spec was announced in June and should start showing up in devices by the end of the year. This will be a game changer as it supports distances up to 300 meters in range. I mention it because if you have trouble outdoors with a distance of Bluetooth, you may want to wait a few more months for the new spec to appear in products. Back to the Octobud. They're light and comfortable. I have small ears and these stay in and, more importantly, don't hurt. You'll get a voice prompt in English when they're connected or disconnected. The sound quality is surprisingly good. Both music and podcasts sounded better than I expected. Now, Silicast sounded great. Elisa didn't ask me to say that. I love swimming with them, but had a couple of attempts to put my phone in the right place where I would have a minimum of audio dropouts. If the earbuds lose connection, you have to get out of the pool and reconnect them. So I settled on the dead center of the pool on one side, and that worked well enough to keep me connected. If you swim laps in a regulation pool, hold out for Bluetooth 5. The Octobuds cannot cover the length of a proper lap pool. Don't be surprised if you have to experiment a bit to get the best connection. Indoors, they work great. I've answered some phone calls with them, and no complaints from the telemarketers that have been unfortunate enough to be my test cases. These are my new favorite headphones for working out and listening to podcasts. One small nit, when they do finally run low on battery, they nag you incessantly until you charge them. Charging takes about an hour and a half. The Octobuds come with some extra ear tips, a charging cable, and a zippered carrying case. If you decide to give them a try, please use Allison's Amazon link and help her cover show expenses. She didn't ask me to say that either. Ciao!
Well, thank you so much, Denise. That was fantastic. I love that review. And I didn't tell her to say those nice things, but I will graciously accept them. One thing she wanted me to note, though, the price went up from $50 to $60 since Denise recorded this review just a few days ago. Thanks to Kenny Lee for telling us about that on the blog. Anyway, these fluctuations do happen on Amazon. You know, the Smart Bean that I've told you about, the little Bluetooth thing that I love so much, it's gone from $12 to $25. Sometimes it goes back to $12. Sometimes it sticks at $25. And let's see, what was the other thing? The Audio-Technica ATR-2100. Sometimes it's like $50, $60. Sometimes it's $80. Then it goes back to $60. So that does happen. I don't quite know why the Octobuds are $60, but from what she says, it sounds like these are still a very good buy. Have you ever been at the airport and there's breaking news on the TV, but you can't hear it? How about you're at a bar and there's a game on and you'd love to be able to hear it? What if you could get the audio sent to your smartphone? Well, that's exactly what Tunity from Tunity.com can do for you. Tunity is available for free in the iOS App Store and the Google Play Store. When you launch Tunity for the first time, you'll be asked to create a free login, or you can use Facebook to log in. Next, you'll be required to turn on location services for the app. I'll explain in a minute why that does make sense. Once you're logged in, you'll see a simple screen that says tap to scan, and there's a rectangle you're supposed to align to the frame of the TV you're looking at. You have to hold the phone still while it scans, then it will say detecting, and if it recognizes the channel you're watching, it will come back and say syncing to and the name of the channel. A second or two after that, you'll hear the audio coming out of your phone. Seriously, it's like magic. One thing to be aware of, whether you scan a when you go to scan a show, make sure it's not on a commercial because it simply won't be able to find the show. It has to be a real-time show that's being broadcast. You can't do it like from a TiVo or something either. Tunity isn't using some wireless connection to the TV that you had it scan. It's doing image recognition of the video to figure out what channel you're watching and then broadcast the audio to your phone over Wi-Fi or cellular data. When you acquire the audio signal for a show you want to watch, you can walk away from that TV and go anywhere. You can even drive away. So think about using this when you're vacuuming or gardening. If you want to listen to a favorite show, you can take it back with you. You can take it with you. The only problem is that if you stop listening or lose signal, you can't get it back unless you can rescan that TV. I mentioned earlier that you have to have location services turned on, and that's because they want to know which feed to send to you. In their FAQs, they say they only support network channels in New York. But if you look at the list of supported channels, they have the major networks listed in PST, which I assume is Pacific Standard Time, and they show them in New York. So it'll say like ABC New York and ABC Pacific PST. I've tried it on lots of channels, and the major ones all worked. I asked Stephen Getz to check it out from Canada, and he was able to see CNN when he tested it. However, Sandy just told me in the chat room she tried it in Las Vegas and it did not work. I'm not sure exactly what these restrictions are, but it's worth a try to give this a shot. I should mention that they have several of the ESPN and Fox. They have several of like ESPN, Fox Sports, NHL, MLB, and NFL networks. Clearly, listening to sports is a big feature for Tunity. Once you're watching a show, you might notice a small lag in the audio. Sometimes it's nearly spot on, you know, it lip syncs perfectly. Sometimes it's really way off, like a couple seconds. I'd scan again if you get a big enough lag to bug you. They have rewind buttons so you can re-listen to something and then fast forward to get back to real time. I've tried using those fast forward buttons to get rid of the lag, but that didn't work. They also have a star on the same viewing screen, and I kind of hoped that would make a list of favorites so I could just go to ABC.live or ABC Live without scanning the TV. But as far as I can see, that star goes away as soon as you stop listening. Now, I don't know what the business model is for Tunity, and I don't know why they require a login. That gives me a bit of pause to make to be sure, so make sure you're okay with that. Tunity will also keep using location services when it's in the background, which I don't like at all. Some apps have, you can have always, never, or you can choose only while I'm using it, but this one only has always or never. So I've gotten into the habit of quitting the app actively as soon as I'm done with it to save battery and, to reduce the kind of information they're getting about me. But let's get back to good news. Tunity, on iOS at least, is accessible. I checked every screen and all buttons were labeled properly and all text was read out correctly. I suppose one challenge would be on how to point it at the TV and get the image centered, but I bet that can be figured out through some trial and error. I also want to give a shout out to Megan Maroney because I heard her talk about this on iOS Today. Very cool find and something I'll definitely be using. My big use case is at the gym. You can listen to the TVs if you have an FM radio tuned to the right station, but who carries an FM radio anymore? They also have jacks on the equipment that work as long as you're not moving around doing weights. But with Tunity, I can listen and I can keep moving around. Check out the free Tunity at Tunity.com or look in your favorite app store. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Security Bits with Bart Bouchat. So we got some exciting stuff this week, Bart?
Well, we got some news. I'll let you decide how exciting or not it is.
Well, I always like Security Bits. I get a lot out of it, and I think it kind of sits in our subconscious as a result of all the things that you teach us in here. In fact, people will have just heard a dumb question, which was about keeping their Macs up to date when macOS Sierra comes out. So pretty cool. People are on top. You know, people think about this stuff now because of this segment that you do.
Okay, well, that is the most important thing, because if you're not aware, then you're not going to be on the lookout.
Exactly. All right, let's kick in.
Okay, so important security news first. This is sort of an update, I guess. So Microsoft have, after much criticism, changed their Windows 10 upgrade dialog. So there is now an obvious button for declining the upgrade, which is such badly needed progress.
So obvious too.
Yeah, it's also probably not unrelated that this happened shortly after Microsoft lost a case to a Californian woman who said that, you know, she didn't know anything about Windows 10 and all of a sudden her work computer was broken. She lost business. Therefore, I'd like $10,000, please. And she won.
Yeah, that was kind of interesting. They didn't, doesn't appear they fought it.
They were going to. And then I think someone went, you do realize you couldn't, she kind of has you there.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so, I'll be curious to see if other people come back and go, yeah, that's a ticket. I lost some stuff too.
I guess you'd need to have documented the loss of earnings and so forth to have a chance.
Yeah, yeah.
But no, it was interesting. And then, like, you know, around about the time that news broke was the time that the new dialogue came out. I don't think that's unrelated. But then they, just in case that people might like them, they then introduced a new, even more naggy dialogue that goes into full screen mode. It does still have a... Well, a remind me later button, but it doesn't actually have a no sod off button. So they managed to snatch the feature from the jaws of victory there. Everyone is looking forward to this bloody offer ending shortly. I mean, I don't know who they think they're trying to please by annoying everyone like this.
But. Well, do you think they're gonna stop this when it doesn't cost money or when it starts costing money? I wouldn't think they'd stop.
Oh, I hope they do. Anyway, Never 10 is a fabulous tool released for free by Steve Gibson that uses, basically, this would never be tolerated in corporations. So Microsoft provided it's a group policy setting to disable this, which, of course, if you're on an Active Directory domain in a work environment, you could set that centrally and push it out to all the computers. But for home users, obviously, you don't have an Active Directory or a system to do all this for you. So Never 10 actually sets those settings in the group policies inside your computer. And then it will never come up again. So you basically go, you download Never 10, it's free and tiny, you run it once, and that's the end of that.
And out of the other side of our mouths, we should be still saying, hey, keep your operating systems up to date.
Right, but this isn't an update, this is an upgrade.
Correct, but there will come a time where this is the only one that's being updated, this one and later ones, right? For security.
Right. So, yeah, if you're on Windows 7, you're getting closer to your end of life. If you're on Windows 8, you still have quite a way to go. And if you're on Vista, you're getting very close.
You should have done something.
Vista's still supported, but it's getting damnable close.
Yeah, but why would you? But I mean, the only reason I would avoid this is if you have something that won't work if you do it.
Which can happen because the newer versions of Windows require 64-bit signed drivers. and there is printers and so forth, which are entirely functional, and scanners and these kind of things, they work absolutely hunky-dory fine, but HP or whoever made it hasn't bothered the backside to release modern drivers for these old devices.
Right.
And even, now the one that really gets me, there are some graphics cards which are working absolutely hunky-dory fine, but are not 64-bit signed.
Okay.
So you, if you click OK to this update and your computer reboots, you will not be able to interact with it.
So that isn't common, though, right? I mean, I understand that's a problem, and you should probably check, but that is, it's not like 50% or something. There are some.
I don't know. I'm not an often enough Windows user. My colleagues in work who are Windows users are very much of the opinion that if you buy a computer that comes with Windows 7, then you know it's all going to work with Windows 7. And unless Windows 7 is out of support, just continue to apply your security updates and leave it at that. For a stress-free life, that is probably the way to go about it. And then the chances are your computer will be ready for hardware replacement if it's a cheap PC by the time the next OS comes around.
Yeah. Yeah.
Again, it is for different strategies for different people, but
sure.
Masquerading an upgrade as an update is a mistake by Microsoft. And that's ultimately why they had to pay this California lady 10 grand.
So I just did a quick search on graphics card doesn't work on Windows 10 and found someone saying, when I check my PC for Windows 10, I get the message, this PC can't run Windows 10. NVIDIA GeForce GT240M, your display won't work. So it doesn't sound like this would necessarily surprise you.
Well, if people who call in to the Tech Guy show or anything to go by, it has surprised people. Whatever sensing they're using is not particularly good ever.
I wonder if they've improved the sensing.
Yeah, well, there's another podcast. Actually, it's the Dutch guys, Stefan Lesage and Co. There's one of the guys on that show, and he is so cranky because it keeps on popping this dialogue up, and he says, okay, fine, upgrade me. It then takes about 2 or 3 hours to crunch through stuff, and then it pops up and it's saying, you cannot update to Windows 10. I don't remember what it is. It's complaining about a driver.
Okay.
And then 2 or 3 days later, it pops up again. Upgrade to Windows 10. So, for God's sake, I can't win. Just go away.
Yeah. There should be a flag set. Can't.
Yeah, or just no. No. I mean, you know, there's the old cliche goes, no means no. There should just be a sod off button. Yeah. Go away. Anyway.
Well, let's talk about something happier. What's Facebook doing now?
There are actually a few Facebook stories, but we're not quite there yet. So the U.S. Department of Homeland Security have requested permission to start collecting social media usernames at the U.S. border. I don't like this.
Isn't that security theater in its most pure form?
Yes, because they're asking permission to ask, not demand. So terrorists are going to voluntarily hand over their profile that says they're terrorists.
Well, and wouldn't you have two?
Right. I mean, yeah, this is
or
pure.
Or don't have one. I mean, there's just so many things you could say. This is just silliness, my opinion.
This is only going to invade the privacy of law-abiding people. This is not going to catch anyone unless they are so stupid you're going to catch them another way.
Yeah. So anyway. And, well, plus the only thing they'd be able to get to is your public stuff anyway. I mean, if you have a Facebook account that you only share with friends.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's just silly. Whatever way I look at it, it's silly.
Yeah.
Now, Facebook. A couple of months back, a Belgian national privacy organization won a major victory against Facebook, which prevented them from tracking Belgians. Facebook appealed that decision, and Facebook have now won that appeal, so all Belgians are being tracked again, whether you're logged into Facebook or not.
So what was the logic in saying they couldn't do it, and what changed?
What changed is that Facebook appealed and basically said, well, we're in Ireland, so we don't give a sod what the Belgians think. And the Belgian court went, yeah, you are kind of in Ireland, okay. And the privacy commissioner...
Oh, they're saying because they're not... Because Facebook doesn't have offices in Belgium? That's why?
Right. From a European point of view, Facebook's HQ is registered in Ireland, which means that it's the Irish Data Protection Commissioner who primarily regulates Facebook in Europe.
Okay.
Anyway, it's a victory for Facebook, a loss for privacy organizations.
Hmm.
but nothing like the loss that a Virginia judge has imposed, one would hope temporarily. In a really horrible case, this is a typical example of difficult cases making really bad laws. So there is a guy accused of doing some really quite horrible things to children. And obviously no one is on his side. But in an attempt to catch this person and get them convicted, the federal government hacked into his computer. And he is now saying that the federal government have no right to do that. And the judge found that no, it's perfectly fine because no one can have a reasonable expectation of privacy on any computer ever because computers can be hacked.
What?
Yes, that is actually what the ruling is. There is no legitimate expectation of privacy on any computer ever.
Wow.
And the logic is, well, there are hackers. They succeed, therefore computers are not private. And that's like saying there are burglaries, therefore your house is not private. I mean, it is insane. The EFF, their heads exploded, I think. So this is going to be appealed. And one would assume that this will be overturned on appeal. But right now, this is like an eek sort of a judgment. Yeah. And obviously, this judge has not the faintest idea what he's talking about.
That's, yeah. No.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Also not good news. Security researchers have found a weakness in full disk encryption on Android phones with Qualcomm chipsets.
Huh. Oh, it's a true statement that all Android phones have full disk encryption by default from some OS version forward. I think that's
I'm not sure that is necessarily true. I guess it's true if the phone has the hardware that's appropriate.
Oh. Okay.
I think the OS will default to enabling it if the hardware is up to it.
Okay. Okay.
They ran into trouble the first time they tried to go default because some of the hardware just couldn't hack it. Yeah. So there may be a little self-test before it's turned on. I'm not 100% sure, but it does certainly prefer to encrypt. If you buy a modern handset, that is what it will do.
Now, if Microsoft had written it, it would keep offering to encrypt your phone and then tell you you can't.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay, so what's wrong with these phones?
Well, okay, so ultimately you can argue it's a sort of a design decision that Qualcomm have made. So the big difference is Apple phones have this concept of a secure element, which has write-only memory. So the private key is written into the secure enclave, and there is no way to get it out. At an electronic level, mm-hmm. there is no way to get that key out. All you can do is hand stuff into there for the private key to act on that stuff and spit out the result, but you can never get the key out.
Okay.
Which means you can't use massive data server farms to try decrypt an Apple device, as the FBI found out earlier this year.
Okay.
And the reason is because you can't get the key out. If you get the key out, then you can have a server farm crunch the numbers and spit out the answer. Now, the Qualcomm chipset does a lot to protect the key, but ultimately you can get the key out in certain situations. Hence, it is possible to crack the key on an array of graphics cards or whatever. So it means that the full disk encryption is much weaker. Now, in theory, the software of the OS should stop that, even though at a physical hardware level you can get the key out.
Right.
In theory, if there were no security vulnerabilities, you couldn't get the key out. But of course, software with no vulnerabilities is a nonsense.
Right.
So the hardware design combined with some software vulnerabilities in certain versions of Android, which affect almost all Android devices, unfortunately, you can get the key out. And once the key is out, now the key comes out in an encrypted form, but you can hammer at it then on an array of graphics cards, which is a very effective way of cracking keys.
So this doesn't mean it's horrible. Right.
If you're running an Android device that cannot get security updates, this is horrible. Because you can't patch yourself against this, right? So this relies on two vulnerabilities. If your device can't be patched against those two vulnerabilities, well, that's a problem.
But if you've got a newer device that can be patched, but the hardware is still not doing a good job of protecting the key, you're just as vulnerable. Well, you're not just vulnerable.
You're not just as vulnerable. You're safe in the near term until someone finds another vulnerability. So, you know, it is.
Wait, I feel like we're mixing two things. Right. But I feel like we're mixing two things together. Having vulnerabilities in the operating system that are being exploited and not being able to upgrade your operating system mm-hmm. is one problem. A separate problem is the fact that the Qualcomm chips are not not fully protecting that private key.
Yes, exactly. Okay. It is indeed a two-step process.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. All right. That was fun. What else you got, Mr. Cheerful?
I'm sorry. Well, I guess this one is arguably cheerful. Another one of the Celebgate hackers goes away for 5 years, or could go away for 5 years. He's pled guilty, and the sentencing is up to 5 years. So maybe by taking a plea bargain, he'll get a bit less. But either way, he is guilty. He's pled guilty.
What I liked the most about this one, so to refresh people's memory, is people love to say that iCloud was hacked when the celebrities' pictures were revealed. And this guy that was just convicted says that he did it using phishing attacks to get information about them in order to hack their accounts, that he did not crack iCloud.
Yes, which is also true of the other hacker who was sent away. These were social engineering attacks. These were silly security questions that were guessed, that kind of thing.
Right. Or, but we don't have to speculate about that in any way, shape, or form. We know it for a fact because the guys that did it said so.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, so anyone who's going on about how, iCloud is very dangerous, it was hacked. No, it wasn't hacked. Some of its users were hacked because they didn't have it very well secured.
Right.
It's different. There's been a fair bit of media hype about some new backdoors that are in the wild for the Mac at the moment. And that is obviously not a pleasant thing that such code is in the wild. But do bear in mind that these are all Trojans. And if you're running Gatekeeper with its default settings, these will also not launch.
But explain again one more time what a Trojan is.
A Trojan is a piece of malware that relies on you to install it. Like a Trojan horse relied on the Trojans to wheel it inside the city gates.
Right. So this is not a virus that spreads automatically that you can get just because. You're not going to get this accidentally. You have to actively take part in this.
Right. Now, you may still get it accidentally, but a different kind of accident, right? So unfortunately, this was spreading, or one of these four, the most noteworthy of these four, called Eleanor. Eleanor was being spread by a fake document converting app that was available from macupdate.com.
Yeah.
So again, we're at these software sites need to go away. Download.com, all of these things, they need to go away. They are becoming a source of problems, not a source of solutions.
So this kind of comes on the heels of what we said last week, that you shouldn't be, if you want to do some discovery about applications on Mac Update, I think you're okay as long as you don't download any of them. But then figure out what the root source for that application is. And if it's not a site you've heard of, if it's not a developer that looks legit and well known, then maybe pause a little bit. And like you said, if you've got the default settings for Gatekeeper, which is the middle setting, right, where it doesn't install stuff from unsigned developers, you had to download this from Mac Update and then override that thing that says this is an unsigned developer. Actively change right click on it to say open it anyway.
Yes. So I was going to say, so the way Gatekeeper behaves, Gatekeeper has three settings. It has only the app store and signed apps, and anything goes. And the default is the middle. And I would say that's a very sane and sensible default.
Yeah. The fact that you and I both run it at the default setting.
We do, yes.
I like to know. And I know there's a certain, I'm pretty sure like Levelator probably isn't a signed app, because it was written 436 years ago. But I'm still going to install it because I know what it is. I know what it's from. And I would override on that case. But even if it's a developer I know, if I get that message, I'll write to him and go, hey, dude, God, why isn't this signed?
And the fee to get something signed is like tiny. It's $99. For the developer for the year, who can then sign as many apps as they like.
Yeah.
So it's not a high bar.
Right.
And the thing is, of course, if you have your app signed and then it's found to be malware, Apple can centrally revoke the certificate for that app, and then that app will stop running on all Macs.
Even better. Yeah.
Even better. So that is what you're getting from it. So it gives Apple the ability to nip any naughtiness you do in the bud. So if you're in the App Store, you're validated before you're put out. And if you're just signing your stuff, it's the other way around. You're allowed to put stuff out, but if you're found to be naughty, it could be pulled away.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think this whole story is more reinforcement for what you've been teaching us. So another good one.
Now, another thing to say, so when you have this middle setting, which is what both of us use and what I definitely recommend, when you double-click an app to run, there is no button to say, oh, run it anyway. You just get a warning saying, this app is not signed, okay. And when you click okay, the app does not run. So in order to actually run an app, you have to make a very deliberate decision. Right-click, open, and then the warning will have a button to allow you to continue.
And by the way, hitting enter does not open. You have
correct.
You have to, again, actively go over and go, no, I really mean it.
Yes, which is very important. Now, what actually happens when you do that is interesting, because that will only happen once if you click go ahead. And the reason it only happens once is because at that point, your Mac signs the app.
Oh.
And then it does have a valid signature. But if anything, if any malware tweaks that app, it will then fail again.
Oh, that's interesting.
Huh. It is interesting. So the reason you don't keep getting the message on the levelator is because the first time you run it after downloading it, it says, oh, this downloaded from the internet is the first warning you get. And then you click by that. And then the next warning you get is it's not signed. And then you right click open and click by that. At that point, it actually does sign it. And then it will be protected from unauthorized editing.
Okay.
Which is really nice because it's an app you're going to keep running, right?
Sure, sure.
So if something naughty happens and tweaks with that app, it will not launch the second time, which is great. So that's how it should be. So it's actually very, I really like how Apple have done this. So it's a very good default, very sensible. And this is just a good reminder to keep, keep it that way. And also to be aware that you can't just download software willy-nilly from the internet. If you do that, you are going to get bitten sooner or later, especially if you're going near pirate sites where you're getting cracked versions of Photoshop and stuff. You're just inviting trouble upon yourself.
I understand that porn stuff is a nice place for some of that too. Not so much anymore.
It's different. It's different.
Okay,
also, gambling is another place that's a bit different. Pirated software. What you're looking for on pirated software is software that you're going to run. There is no need to trick you with an ad into downloading a codec you don't actually need.
Oh, right.
There's
right.
No need to try attack you through malware through a flash vulnerability, which is how you would get in trouble on the other, on the gambling sites or on the porn sites. So the pirated software is just so much easier. You are downloading something you are planning to run. So it's just like, oh, okay, boom, and it's away. So it is different. I'm not saying there are not other dodgy parts of the internet, but that is like an extra dodgy thing.
Right,
because your
right.
aim is to get an executable, which you will then execute. Also, just a related story, Naked Security have done a really nice dig into Eleanor. So, how it works, the whole story behind it. So if you're curious as to how these things work, then and I think you should be curious, because then you're better able to protect yourself. If you understand what the bad guys are at, then you won't be surprised by their tactics.
Okay.
So cool. That link is in the show notes. TP-Link have lost control of one of their setup domains, which at first glance sounds horrific.
So TP-Link is a router manufacturer.
It's a router manufacturer. So the way it works is their boxes have a URL on the back that says, to set up your router, go to this URL. Now, that's not actually going out to the internet because you haven't set up your router yet. So you don't have internet access. Oh. The way it actually works is that all of the TP-Link routers, they run a little internal DNS server that says if the domain name is this special domain name, return the IP address of the router, so 192.168.0.1 or whatever it happens to be, 10.0.0.1, whatever. So they've lost control of that domain on the internet, but that actually makes no difference to anyone setting up the router, because the router is going to answer them back with a fake answer anyway, because that's the whole point of this domain. It's a pure stupidity. It's an own goal they shouldn't have scored on themselves. And it means if you try to go to this URL when you're not on a TP-Link router, you can end up in some bad guy's place. But if you're using it to manage your TP-Link router, you're okay, because the router itself hijacks that domain. Okay, so security researchers have found that at least 10 million Android phones, of which 0.85 million are in the United States, have been infected with auto-routing malware. And this malware is thriving for the simple reason that the vast majority of Android phones are running known, documented, vulnerable software. Because people can't patch it. I mean, it should come as no surprise to anyone. This is the bad old days of Windows 95 all over again. Devices on the internet with the known security holes.
So I know that we don't like overreach of government, but I would really like to see, at least in the United States, I can't talk about anybody else's country, I would like to see a law that says, no, you have to let people have upgraded software. You have to.
Yeah.
You don't get a choice of that.
We already have laws that say if you sell someone an electronic device, you have to provide them a warranty on that device for a certain amount of time.
Yeah, we don't have that, but that's a good one.
No, you have a certain amount of time. I think your amount of time is 90 days.
Oh, maybe.
But it is non-zero, right? In Europe, it's 2 years.
Right.
Not in the UK anymore because they decided they didn't like customer protection. So in the EU countries, it's 2 years we get. But there's no earthly reason that you could, in fact, almost argue that, you know, that means that they should also provide security updates for those 2 years. But it's not explicit, so let's make it explicit. You're dead right, absolutely. It's like you're not allowed to defraud people. And selling someone a piece of software or a piece of hardware with firmware that connects to the internet that you do not keep up to date is not appropriate. That is, to me, that should just be illegal. As illegal as selling someone, what was that car whose gas tank blew up every time you had a small accident. Was it the Pinto or something? Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, it's like that. It's the digital equivalent of the Pinto. So arguably it's illegal anyway, but it's not explicit, so let's make it explicit. I think it's coming because we know that the US FTC has opened an investigation into updates of mobile devices.
I hope so. Please. Because, you can't blame the users this time. We can't lecture. We can't wag our finger at them.
We can blame Google for having invented a stupid model with two middlemen between them and the customer. And that's what's wrong. And people mocked Apple for telling the carriers where to go and telling the carriers, no, we are sending updates directly to the phone. But Apple have been proved 110% right.
Yeah.
Notable breaches. This is never a fun section. The US IRS have yet again killed their beleaguered e-file PIN system after yet more suspicious activity seemed to be targeting it. So this system already lost a few hundred thousand people's tax information earlier this year. Then they took it offline for a while. Then they tweaked it a bit. They put it back online with more monitoring. And their monitoring now found out that it was being abused yet again. So they've just said, okay, fine, it's dead.
Jeez. Okay. Yeah. Well, I guess that's good news if they killed it.
It is good news that it was finally killed. But that they killed it because it was being abused yet again is not so good. Very similar to the story we had last week or last 2 weeks ago about a database of voters being leaked by someone who bought it off a company. So basically a customer of a company that sells data, leaking the data by not putting a password on it. Well, now there's something called the Thomson Reuters World Check, which is basically an intelligence database. It contains details of 2.2 million suspected terrorists and money launderers. And again, this is data that can be bought by contractors and so forth. And someone bought that data and then accidentally exposed it to the world.
Why is it bad? Why is this one a bad thing?
Suspected. There is no due process here. There is absolutely no due process. People could be on this list by total accident. Their name might be spelled similar to a guy who's in Al-Qaeda.
Okay. A database that classifies people, major charities, activists, and mainstream religious institutions as potential terrorists or money launderers was found available.
So remember, there is no vetting on this. This is just potential, right? So this is not the kind of thing that should be in the hands of the general public because then vigilantes could end up murdering innocent people.
Yeah.
People who have not had any chance to have their day in court.
Great. Okay.
Now, we've talked a few times about the Wendy's breach that took off last November-ish. And initially they said, it's only been a few restaurants, but 5% of our restaurants is okay. And then last month they sort of primed us for bad news by saying, it's kind of more, we'll get back to you. Well, now we know it's a lot more. It's 1,025 locations, and they have conveniently published a list broken down by state. So if you're interested, it's available from the link. So the link in the show notes is to the Krebs security article, and that contains the link to the state-by-state breakdown of all the affected Wendy's restaurants.
So this was a point-of-sale terminal problem?
Correct. So credit card exfiltration.
I don't understand how only some. That seems odd, doesn't it?
Well, they're a franchise, aren't they?
Yeah.
So that means that being a Wendy's means that you're kind of running your own business. So maybe a whole bunch of Wendy's contract with the same other contractor who provides them with the point of sale terminals. And then there's a firmware bug in a certain firmware version of a certain brand of handset. And that's what was hacked. I mean, that's usually how these things go in large organizations.
Okay. But they don't. Apparently they don't all use the same.
Right, which is kind of what you would expect because it is a franchise. So you're not going to have a uniform system the whole way through a franchise.
Okay. Great.
Yeah, now the last one just showed up on my radar about half an hour ago, just as I was preparing to record. Someone responding to the police killing of Alton Sterling in Baton Rouge, decided it would be somehow helpful to leak the contact details and names of 50,000 police personnel in Baton Rouge.
Oh my gosh.
This is not helpful in any way, shape, size, or form.
So is this like home phone numbers and such?
Yeah. Oh. And names and so forth of police personnel. That's just really not what you want in this situation. It's absolutely so counterproductive. So suggested reading. I promise we'll end on a fun story.
I hope so.
No, I promise. I always do. Okay, so we don't get to go to our fun story immediately. There's an important warning from Brian Krebs. Beware of online reviews, because a lot of them are fake. And this can actually have much more serious consequences than you think. If you have a member of your family who is suffering from drug addiction or something and you are looking for treatment for them, be aware that organizations like the Church of Scientology have fraudulent reviews to try to attract vulnerable people into their organizations.
Ooh.
Which is, like, the ick factor on this is it goes up to 11. So speak to a health professional to get advice on where to get treatment for your relatives who need it. Don't rely on internet reviews. A whole batter of them are fake by people who you probably don't want vulnerable people sent to.
Hmm.
Yeah, as I say, we're not at the good news yet. However, now we're into two very useful things. Naked Security do a lot of really good public service stuff as far as I'm concerned. I'm a huge fan of the website. They're by Sophos, so they have a... They're not entirely altruistic in writing a really good security blog because they're also selling security products, but they do write a really good security blog. And something they often do is give guides to help you change something to make you more secure. And this week they released a guide for setting up two-factor auth on Amazon and a guide for setting up two-factor auth on Twitter. So anyone who hasn't done so and is interested, there's a nice step-by-step, here's how you do it for both of those from Naked Security. Now, the Amazon one comes with a caveat. Only Americans get to protect their Amazon account. Foreigners can get stuffed. I tried to follow the instructions and the button simply wasn't there. So I hit the button to chat to someone from Amazon. And someone who made me very angry said, no, that's only for Americans, but don't worry, we take your security seriously. It's like, no, sorry, I was going to, if you had said, we understand this is important and it's coming soon, I would have given it to you. But the fact that you've given me this marketing rubbish... So I really had to go with them, frankly, for that despicable attitude.
Yeah.
Don't lie to your customers. Sorry, don't lie to people like that. Oh, we take your privacy seriously. No, you don't. Americans have had this for bloody ages. You don't care.
So there is no two-factor authentication for Amazon unless you're inside the United States?
Well, there certainly isn't in Amazon.co.uk. Maybe Amazon.fo and Amazon.de have it. I couldn't verify that because my friend German aren't great. But Amazon.co.uk definitely do not. And that's unfortunately where I'm forced to shop because of my geographic location.
Right.
Although that may change shortly because Amazon.co.uk is only a viable solution for me because right now, this minute, Britain is in the European Union. Amazon are going to have to either put an English version on their F4 or DE site or actually open a .ie site.
Oh, wow.
Because there's no way I'm paying import duty on top of the currency exchange. Now, at the moment, with the pound having gone through the floor, I've made quite a few Amazon purchases, so very advantageous.
I would bet.
But yeah, so long term, Amazon are going to have to completely change their European operations if the Brits go ahead and actually leave. It's amazing, actually, all the fallout from
ramifications up. I wouldn't have thought of. So yeah. I don't understand why Amazon would do this country specific. I mean, I guess because they've got separate web installations. Everything is different every country, which I found out in making my 46 different Amazon affiliate accounts.
They're run by different people. It's not a unified organization. It's a very franchisee sort of organization. They're very, very independent from each other.
One would hope that, I mean, franchisee is a good model. There's nothing wrong with it, but there are certain overarching things you do, you know, like the logo for Wendy's is always the logo for Wendy's. You don't get to have a mustache on or at one store, right? I would think one of the things you would do is have the same security model.
I would agree with you on that, but that doesn't seem to be what Amazon think, which is disappointing.
I wonder whether you just got an idiot. Let's hope so.
Well, they certainly were an idiot, but unfortunately, the truth is the feature is not there. The button is missing.
Sure,
the interface is exactly the same as the one of the screenshot, except that button is not there.
The reason I mention that is just in context, we went to a hotel recently for our summer vacation with family where every person was clearly trained to simply spit out the first words that came into their mind when you asked them a question, and then to make sure you were never asked again, so you would just run away. And the answers we got, I mean, they were hysterically different. You'd ask one person, and they'd be real easy questions, you know, like how much does a refrigerator cost would be a different answer depending on who we talked to. And I think about that, whether they simply were not trained to know the right answer to the question, so they made something up.
Yeah, that is amazing. Now, the impression I got was that I was getting pre-made corporate BS.
Yeah.
That basically, this is the line we spend.
Your security is important to us.
Yes, exactly. That's it. It was exactly. We take your security very seriously. No, you bloody well don't. If you did, you would not have denied us this basic security feature. It's 2016, yeah. Not 2006.
Well, how about Twitter? You said that Naked Security's got one on two-factor authentication on Twitter. Did you succeed
there?
They
do indeed. Yes. Oh, yeah, I succeeded there years ago. I've had my Twitter secured for years now.
I haven't got my nerve up to do any more of these yet.
Well, Twitter is just a plain old SMS loop, so it's very straightforward.
Okay.
And it's only, I mean, how often do you sign into Twitter? Once you've set your client up, that's it. You're done, right? I mean, maybe you'll use the web interface once or twice.
No, there's lots of other times it does it where you're in an app that then allows you to access Twitter. You're going to have to say, set up the account. You have to put in your credentials in order to connect it. Yeah, it happens. It happens a lot. It's out once.
Okay. Maybe I'm different then, but I tend to use, if you're using OS X or iOS's built-in share functions, that's one authentication, and any app that uses that sharing feature then works.
Yeah, the sharing function doesn't always work the way I want it to. So, I mean, I know you don't use Facebook, but if you're in Photos and you say, I want to share it, there's a bunch of features not available. Like you can't tag a person in the post you make. So the only way to do it right is to start in the Facebook app and then go backwards and access your photos, and then you can tag people. So,
okay, but is there a Twitter equivalent? Because everything I've ever used where I wanted to tweet something has just been perfect. Like my RSS reader is perfect.
I tend not to do it though, because I like to at people, and I can't do a search or anything like that for somebody's name. So I'm trying to call somebody's attention. Like doing my affinity photo post, for example, I want to know what affinity's Twitter name is. Well, I have to go over to Twitter to find that anyway. So I would generally do it the other way around.
Okay, but then if you do it the other way around, then you don't have this problem either, because your Twitter client is well and truly yours.
Oh, you're right. That's a bad example. Shut up.
I think Twitter, in my experience anyway, Twitter has been a spectacularly easy one.
Okay, good.
Also in the good news category, Google have released, it's good news. Google have released a tool called My Activity, and it will show you what Google knows about you and probably scare the pants off you.
So the good news is they've got a tool for you. The bad news is you won't like what you find.
That was certainly my experience with the tool, because I'm not a heavy Google user. And I was like, holy mother of divine.
Yikes.
Yeah, and you know, when you're having political discussions with people, you end up searching for the strangest of things, which if taken out of context, make you look like quite the loony.
So
what you're actually doing is trying to research what these other crazy people on the internet are saying. And your search history ended up looking like you are one of the crazy people on the internet.
So basically it's anytime, you use Google search, right?
I use Google search, yeah. I've never signed into Google, but that doesn't seem to stop them. They seem to figure it out anyway, probably from a cookie from Google Plus or something. Because I don't sign into Chrome. I don't use Chrome at all. In fact, I'm just a Safari user.
Do you actively log out of Google Plus when you're done doing something in there?
No, I probably don't.
Yeah, so you are logged into Google.
Yeah, because Google decided to consolidate everything. So you can either log into all Google tools or no Google tools. You can't pick and choose anymore.
Yeah, I'm basically just seeing piles of searches, which I would expect them to know about.
Yeah, I was...
Doesn't seem to be a big surprise.
Yeah, it was tying stuff together I didn't like. Anyway, they know a lot, and now you know what they know. So it's no more, oh, I wonder what they know. There you go. You can see. And again, transparency is good. I like that. It's a nice tool, and it's good of them to put it out.
All right.
Just sort of to remind everyone that the Internet of Things is still in the experimental and insecure stage, researchers have found a botnet of 25,000 IoT CCTV cameras.
Closed-circuit TV cameras. So those are not your regular TV cameras? I mean, with the TV. They're not your regular security cams?
Right. They're security cameras that are connected to the internet. In other words, they're IoT security cameras.
Well, but CCTV has a specific definition well beyond that it's...
It does, except that it's not closed circuit anymore as soon as it's connected to the internet, is it?
How do we call them CCTV? How do you know these are connected to the internet? I mean,
because they're on a botnet that is on the internet. That's what, like, a botnet can't exist off the internet. They are on the internet and they're being used to do denial of service attacks. So they are a botnet on the internet that is being weaponized to attack websites to take them off the air.
Okay, but
they are.
But if you buy a Nest webcam or a Nest security camera, that is not a CCTV. Is that correct? So it wouldn't be in this botnet?
To be honest, I don't think the word CCTV has any meaning anymore, because I don't think
it's CCTV. Do you think they just used it to mean webcams?
Well, I think that nowadays, something that, like, a closed circuit television is supposed to be something that's, you know, a closed circuit system.
Yeah.
So the concept of an internet connected closed circuit television is absolute garbage to me. It's like, it's not closed. You just put it on the public internet.
Okay.
Anyway, this is not to say that all cameras are in this botnet. It's to say that using vulnerabilities in cameras, hackers were able to assemble a botnet of 25,000 cameras and use them to actually attack actual websites. So they weaponized people's cameras.
Great. Okay. Yeah.
And not to spy on them, to just attack websites, which I guess is slightly the good news. At least when pictures. A story that was completely hyped in terms of the first paragraph and the headline, but is nonetheless a true story. Google are beginning to experiment with new encryption ciphers, which are quantum computer proof, because our current crypto is very vulnerable to quantum computing. Basically, they rely on mathematics. It's hard to do without a quantum computer, but easy to do with a quantum computer. And these new algorithms are hard to do both without and with a quantum computer. So to see Google experimenting with these in the real world is an interesting move into the future.
Yeah, it's so from what I can understand, they're trying to run these algorithms to see what we will be able to do in the future. They don't see this as the solution for the future yet, what they're doing, but they're trying to study what they can do.
Yeah, so they're experimenting with a whole new branch of mathematics to do encryption with.
So can you give us 30 seconds on why quantum computing can hack things like TLS, but we can't do that today?
Okay, so the stuff like the algorithms we have at the moment are based on the fact that it's easy to take two prime numbers and multiply them together, but it's very hard to start off with the result of that and figure out what the two prime numbers were.
Okay.
So factoring of primes is hard. Unfortunately, quantum computers are inherently massively parallel, and to a quantum computer, that's not a hard problem. They can factorize quickly. Therefore,
so in this case, quantum computer just think faster.
Right. They can, yeah. So the reason, like, to factorize a large number as is used in modern encryption with a modern key size could take you 1, 2, or 3 times the age of the universe to do on modern hardware. Therefore, it's considered secure. I think that's a perfectly valid way to call something secure.
Okay.
But a quantum computer can slice through that in a matter of maybe a few hours, depending on the power of the quantum computer, or maybe even a few days or weeks. But either way, it's going to be so many orders of magnitude more efficient at that problem that it goes from being, you know, fractions of the age of the universe, or multiples even of the age of the universe, to being a much more human scary time frames, depending
on
how many.
So you're going to have to update x8passwd.net when that time comes?
Well, no, because that's not relying on public key crypto.
I'm sorry, it's actually Password Haystacks has to have a third section that says, and with quantum computers, 3 minutes to crack that 800-character password.
Well, no, because it's not password cracking, right? It's not cracking the password. It's cracking the encryption on HTTPS.
Right, but couldn't you use quantum computers to do this, to hack passwords?
No, because they don't rely on factorization. They rely on how many times do you have to guess. Not the same thing.
But I thought I could think of quantum computers as simply faster.
They're faster at some things. They're not magic. There are mathematical functions that quantum computers are good at that we currently are not good at. And factorization is one of those things that quantum computers are good at.
Okay, so it's not just purely guessing that it's faster at.
It's not purely guessing. It can factorize. And at the moment, our crypto is based on the fact that we can't efficiently factorize.
So that's good that Google's working on this, right?
Absolutely, it's good. But the opening paragraph of that Ars Technica article is ridiculous. You know, the imminent collapse of HTTPS. No, it bloody well isn't as upscaring people. It's obviously, I'm blaming some editor somewhere who got their hands on a perfectly reasonable article, stuck a stupid headline on it, and a silly OTT first paragraph.
OTT?
Over the top.
Okay.
Finally, our sort of fun story to end on. Now, this initially sounds uber scary, but it's not. It's just fun.
Wait. I'm sorry. I got to read the word for word what this first paragraph says. Like many forms of encryption in use today, HTTPS protections are on the brink of a collapse. It could bring down the world as we know it.
Yeah. OTT.
Okay.
Absolutely. The thing, all right, and the reason we were slightly slow at starting is because this popped into my newsreader just as we were about to go on air. And I said, okay, I need to read out why that headline is garbage. And sure enough, the actual body of the article in no way justifies the opening paragraph or the title, which makes me think that one person wrote the body of the article, which is well written and sane, and some other idiot put the paragraph and the heading on the top.
Okay.
Okay, so researchers have found a new way to get data out of a computer that is completely isolated from the network. There is no physical connection between this computer and the outside world, so they can find a way to air gap data, which sounds really scary. Except for the fact that it is very, very, very slow. You're talking about a few days to get a few hundred bytes across. Because the way it works is by speeding up and slowing down the fan.
What?
Yeah. So you speed up so basically there's a range of frequencies which the human ear can't tell the difference between, but a microphone can.
Mm-hmm.
And so you control the fan speed and you have one of that range of frequencies meaning one and another one meaning zero. And then you ramp the fan up and down. But of course, the fan takes time to spin up and to spin down. So you can have a fast bit rate. So the bit rate comes out like in a few baud. Right.
This is cool, though. That's mode. Fun.
Exactly. That's why it's the last story of the day. Someone thought, is this possible? And they did it. And yes, it is possible. No, it is not an actual threat in the real world. But it's fun. I love that people do this kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. That's the hacker thing, the good hacker type thing, right? Hey, could we do this? Yeah. Practical? Nope.
Exactly. We have now tested whether or not this is something we should lose sleep over. Sleep tight. It's all good.
I love that. That's fantastic.
Yes. There are a few more stories in suggested reading, but I will leave those up to people's discretion.
All right. Well, I'm glad you ended up on a happier note.
This is something I do intentionally. You ask me to, and I do.
Okay, good. So we forget how sad we were in the middle.
Yeah, but not enough to forget to look out for ourselves.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Bart. We'll talk to you again in a couple of weeks.
Talk to you in a few weeks. And until then, stay patched and stay secure.
Well, that's going to wind us up for this week. Do not forget to send in your dumb questions like Steve did and your comments and suggestions by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com. Follow me on Twitter @podfeet and check out the NoSilicast Google Plus community and our Facebook group. Those are at podfeet.com/Google Plus and podfeet.com/Facebook. You have to ask permission to enter. I don't know why they make us do that, but Steve really likes pushing the accept button. So go head on over to Facebook and join the group. If you want to join in the fun of the live show like DRQ did for the first time this week, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time and join the friendly and enthusiastic NoSilla Castaways. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.